Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello. This is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Mathematics. Our guest today is Chris Bernhardt, author of Quantum Computing for Everyone. This is a book that involves a lot of mathematics, but most of it is accessible to anyone who survived high school algebra. Even a math phobic can read the book, skip the math, and then more than hold his or her own in any but the highest level discussion of quantum computing. For those of us who love math, the underlying math is elegantly simple and beautifully presented, and the same can be said of the non-mathematical material. Chris, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Jim.
Chris, what motivated you to write this book?
Well, quantum computing is full of sort of fascinating, surprising, and unintuitive results. So it's a very interesting subject. And what I wanted to do was to make this accessible to as wide an audience as possible by making the mathematics as simple as possible. So, I mean, I feel that I've stripped the mathematics right down to its essence, and that now anyone who's, you know, comfortable with high school algebra and comfortable following along examples in the book should be able to understand what's going on. So I'm really trying to make this, you know, fascinating subject accessible to a wide audience.
I certainly think you expanded the audience. There's no question about that. And I really enjoyed reading the book. And as I say, I recommend that people read it, even if they aren't familiar with or comfortable with the math, because it gives a really nice outline of quantum computing.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. What is the difference between a bit and a qubit?
So I think most people are familiar with bits. They're either just zero or one. And so they're very simple things. There's not much two bits, just zero or one. And they're often represented by switches in the on or off position. Qubits are, of course, the fundamental unit in quantum computing. And there's two things to remember here. One is that when we actually do the computation, we'll be manipulating qubits. But at the end, we want an answer. So at the end, we have to read out an answer. And we make a measurement on our qubits. And at this point, the measurement, we read it off bits. So the final answer is in bits. It's be zeros and ones, so much like this classical computation. Now, there are two fundamental qubits. There's the zero qubit and the one qubit. If you measure the zero qubit, sort of unsurprisingly, you get a zero as a bit coming out. If you measure a one qubit, again, you get one as the outcome of the measurement. One is the bit. But with qubits, we can put them in a superposition of zeros and ones. So this is a mixture of the zero qubit and a mixture of the one qubit. So here, often we say something like A times the zero qubit plus B times the one qubit. It's a mixture of the two qubits. And these two numbers, A and B, remember it's A times the zero qubit and B times the one qubit, have to satisfy this condition that A squared plus B squared equals one. Now, if we were to measure that qubit, it suddenly jumps to either the zero qubit and we read off a zero, or it jumps to a one qubit and we read off a one. And the probability it jumps to zero is given by A squared, and the probability it jumps to 1 is given by b squared. So this is something that's important to remember, that at the end here, we're only getting zeros and ones out of it. And if we measure a qubit that's in a superposition of states, it's going to jump to either 0 or 1, and we're going to get a 0 or 1 out as the final result.
You know, I think you hit on one of the most fascinating aspects of quantum mechanics, the fact that measurements affect outcomes. And under what circumstances do measurements affect outcomes?
So here, when measuring a qubit, I mean, the measurement always affects the outcome. I mean, unless, of course, you've got the zero qubit, which we can represent as 1 times the zero qubit plus 0 times the 1 qubit, in which case the probability you get a 0, of course, is 1 squared, which is 1. The probability you get a 1 is 0. So the measurement, I mean, always affects the outcome. But here, what's important to remember, it's a probabilistic result. So if we've got this qubit in the form A times 0 plus B times 1, then the probability we get a 0 is A squared, and the probability we get 1 is B squared. And so at first sight, this doesn't seem to be a useful property. And it's certainly not in popular descriptions. We say that we often see that qubits are both 0 and 1 at the same time. But things are certainly more complicated, that when you measure these things, you either get 0 or you get 1, and there's a probability associated to that.
You know, one of the things that you state, and I think I saw it in the promotional material for the book, is that you feel that qubits are more fundamental than bits. And that fascinated me, and perhaps you could explain this.
Yeah, so when you're doing a computation, of course, if you're just doing a classical computation with bits, as zeros or ones, you could do exactly the same thing with the zero qubit and the one qubit. You would never put them in superposition of states. So here you can do any computation, classical computation, in theory, with a quantum computer. But you then got this other thing that you can do with qubits. You can put them in a superposition of states, and you can also entangle them. So you've got these two other properties. And it's not clear that when you first come across them, these are useful properties. But there are two things that you can do with qubits that you can't do with bits. And so in some sense, computing with qubits is a more fundamental operation. That here there are things you can do with them you can't do with classical bits. Anything you can do with a classical bit, you can do with a qubit. So it's more fundamental.
Okay, I can understand that point of view. One of the things that I liked about your book was that it gives a lot of history and relation to the physics that has led to the development of quantum computers. And what was the Stern-Gerlach experiment, which took place almost a century ago?
Right. So this took place in 1922 in Frankfurt. So there were two physicists, Otto Stern and Walter Gerlach. And of course, this is the beginning of the quantum era. So people are doing experiments to try and find out what exactly quantum physics and quantum mechanics is all about. And so they were trying to measure the spin or the, we'll talk about the how little silver atoms are magnetized. So silver atoms act like little magnets. They have a north pole and a south pole. And this is often described as spin. So saying spin up, spin down, we're talking about the north and south pole of the these little magnets. And so what Stern and Gerlach wanted to do was to try and measure the axis of spins of various silver atoms going through their experiment. And so they designed an experiment to measure it in the vertical direction, so that if the north pole was upwards, their equipment would send it to an extreme up position. If the north pole was downwards, it would send it to an extreme down position. And if it was the axis was in between those, it would send it somewhere between that extreme up position and extreme down position. And they were collecting these silver atoms on a glass plate. And you might expect that they'd end up with a line where, you know, the magnets that were in with their axes aligned vertically would be at one of the extreme points, and if the axis was aligned horizontally, it would be halfway between them. But what they found was something quite surprising. What they found was that whenever they measured the direction of this magnet, it was always aligned vertically. Either the North Pole was upwards or the North Pole was downwards. It was never right or left. It was always up or down. And so it was quite a surprising result.
That led to something that you call a three consecutive spins experiment. What's that and what can we learn from it?
Yeah, so when you measure then, what Stern and Gerlach found, that when you measure the spin in the vertical direction, or whether you, same thing as measuring the north-south axis in the vertical direction, it's vertically aligned. You either get spin up or spin down or north pole up or north pole down. And the question is, well, what exactly are the rules? So if you repeat the same experiment twice, so if we again measure second time in the vertical direction, then a silver atom has its north pole upwards after the first measurement will also have its north pole upwards after the second measurement. So we have some consistency, some repeatability. So that's one thing. So here it's not just a random result each time. We can repeat experiments and get the same results. And what they did was they measured the spin in the vertical direction and then in the horizontal direction. And what they found was that half of the silver atoms that had their north poles upwards, when they measured in the horizontal direction, had their north poles in the right direction and half in the left direction. So then again, everything was now in the right-left direction. And the three spins experiment is to again now measure in the vertical direction. So if you measure first and the spin is upwards or north pole's upwards, then you measure again and the spin is now right in the right direction. What happens if you measure again in the first in the vertical direction? You get north, which you did originally, and the answer is you don't. So this is lost all memory about that first measurement. And so these experiments were just describing what goes on physically. And then, of course, you have to try and come up with some simple mathematical model that describes what's going on.
One of the things that I liked was, as I said, I like the fact that you give the history and connection to physics and a lot of this stuff. And my impression when I read about the polarized filters experiment, it's basically the three consecutive spins experiment with polarized filters, which is a lot more intuitive to see than the spins, because we can see what happens when we turn with the polarized filters.
So that's exactly it. Yeah, so it is. I just think that the mathematics, though, becomes a little bit easier when you're talking about I think the mathematics is a little bit easier to see for the spins than for the polarized filter. But you're right, it's exactly the same experiment, two different versions of the same experiment.
Okay, now we come to what is absolutely one of the most perplexing aspects of quantum mechanics. What is entanglement? I'll bet you've been asked this before.
Okay, so suppose that we have a cube. You have a qubit, I have a qubit. And suppose it's in a mixture of the zero qubit and the one qubit in such a way that when I measure my qubit, I get zero with probability half or one with probability half. And the same thing for you. When you measure your qubit, you're going to get zero with probability half, one with probability one half. Okay, so if our qubits are entangled, then what happens is that when you measure your qubit, you might get zero with probability one half. Then when I measure my qubit, I get zero. If you get zero, I get zero. If you get one, I get one. Our results are correlated. So that whoever makes their, so suppose you make your measurement before I make my measurement, you could get either zero or one. As soon as you measure it, say you get zero, then we know that when I'm going to measure my qubit, I'm also going to get zero. So the first measurement affects the state of the other qubit. It's a most remarkable result.
It is fascinating. Who are Alice, Bob, and Eve? What are they doing, and how does it relate to quantum computing?
Okay, so Alice, Bob, and Eve come from cryptography, and Alice and Bob want to communicate with each other, and they're trying to do it securely. They don't want to be intercepted, so perhaps they're exchanging financial information or something like that. And Eve is an interloper. She's trying to listen in and trying to detect what's going on. And there are various methods of encryption we use all the time. So for instance, we do online banking. We're encrypting what we're doing on our computer and what the bank's computer is. We're hoping that Eve or anyone else is not intercepting. And so quantum computing gives us various ways of designing encryption programs. So one way is to use what's called a key. So suppose that you and I were going to communicate using a secure channel. We're going to design some sort of encryption method. And suppose it's going to be based on a long number. And a lot of encryption methods are based on long numbers. So you have this long number. I have this long number. It's the same number. It's a shared key. And we're going to encrypt and decrypt using this long number. Well, the first thing we've got to do is somehow get this long number so that we both have it and nobody intercepted it as we were trying to share this key. So this is called key distribution. And we can do this using entangled particles. So the basic idea here is that this idea that, you know, when you measure your qubit and I measure my qubit, if they're entangled, we've got this correlation between the results. And we can also do this in a very clever way that detects whether Eve is intercepting. Because if Eve intercepts our qubits, then she's going to have to make a measurement. And when she makes a measurement, our qubits become disentangled. And there are clever ways of telling whether qubits are entangled or not.
What is interference and how does it affect quantum computing?
Okay, so interference, the simplest example of interference would be if you have a qubit that's in the state A0 plus B1, A times the 0 qubit plus B times the 1 qubit, and you remember that A squared plus B squared had to equal 1. Well, if we just change the sign of A and look at minus A times 0 plus B times 1, then that also satisfies minus A squared plus B squared will also equal 1. So we might have two qubits, one A plus A times the 0 qubit plus B times 1, and one minus A times the 0 qubit plus B times 1. And if we have a way of adding those, then the A and the minus A will cancel, and we'll get rid of the 0 qubit. We'll just be left with a one qubit. And this is really analogous to interference and waves, that if you drop a stone in a lake and you see these ripples expanding outwards, if I would drop a stone in the lake as well, and the ripples expand outwards, and then here they might interfere. So my ripples might interfere with your ripples, and the waves either add constructively, so here, I mean, the amplitudes, if my wave is up in the air and your wave is up in the air, these amplitudes add. And if they could also act destructively and cancel one another out. And so you see these interference patterns. And that's really related to this idea of canceling bits out in quantum computations. And I mean, I like to think of it in terms of one thing we're familiar with is sort of noise-canceling headphones, where we're getting this sort of noise coming in and the music we're trying to listen to, and the noise-canceling headphones sort of cancel out the noise and just leave the music we're trying to listen to. And that's what we're trying to do with quantum computations, that there's this the bit of the computation that we really don't want, we're really sort of noise, and so we can try and use interference to cancel that bit out and amplify the bit that we're really interested in. So that's the sort of, it's a vague idea of what we're doing with quantum computations.
Whenever I read about quantum computing, I always read about the difficulty that one has of manufacturing computers with 2, 3, 5 qubits, etc. So what is required to produce real-world useful qubits?
Well, so here, I'm not a physicist, so producing actual quantum computers is difficult. So they're doing things like they've got ions trapped in lattices. For quantum communication, and we can use polarized photons. But one of the real problems is that with qubits, of course, however you encode them, whether in terms of little particles or photons, is that they tend to interact with the rest of the universe. You get some sort of electromagnetic wave coming towards your computer and it interacts with the qubit. It jumps to something else. So from my perspective, one of the most interesting results was something that Peter Shor did in the 1990s, and that was he showed that you could error correct. And that, and this is one of the things that led to people thinking, well, actually, perhaps you could actually build quantum computers. And so here, the idea is that, that your errors will creep into your quantum computation because things are going to happen. And what you want to do is you want to try and correct errors. So if your qubits flipped from 0 to 1 or something, you want to be able to correct that. And of course, what you're not allowed to do is you're not allowed to make a measurement of your qubit. As soon as you measure your qubit, it's going to jump to either 0 or 1. And so it's a stunning result that here you can actually detect whether a mistake has been made, there's an error crept in, and you can correct it. And all the time, you never make a measurement of the qubit. It's just, it's one of these things that when you first hear about it, it just sounds impossible. But then you look at the mathematics and say, well, that's really clever.
You know, one of the things that I enjoyed about your book is that you learn a lot about quantum mechanics en passant. I realize that your focus is quantum computing, but it's a great book to read for people who want also an introduction to some of the interesting ideas in quantum mechanics. And I'd like to touch on that for a little bit. What is the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics?
Yeah, so let me just say, I really agree with you. I think that quantum computing is the ideal way to get into quantum mechanics. But I mean, a lot of people, you know, the pioneers of quantum computing came from quantum mechanics. And so, I mean, they tend to use a lot of mathematics. I mean, they're, you know, very used to using sophisticated mathematics. But I think the direction in the future should go the other way, that you should learn quantum computing first, and then quantum mechanics, because you get all these ideas in a very elementary form.
That's a very intriguing idea.
The Copenhagen interpretation. Niels Bohr lived in Copenhagen. He had an institute there. And Heisenberg was also there for some time. And the Copenhagen interpretation is the interpretation I've been describing, that here you get this sudden jumping as soon as you make a measurement. And of course, this is something that Einstein did not like. I mean, he didn't like this jumping. He didn't feel that in physics you should have these probabilities coming in. And he also didn't like the idea of entanglement, which he called this spooky action at a distance.
You know, there were two, we're leading to what I consider one of the most fascinating results of the 20th century, but perhaps you could briefly describe what local realism and hidden variables are.
Yeah, so local realism is, and again, this is something that Einstein believed in. So if we go back to gravitation and look at what Newton did with gravitation. So he came up with an equation that told you the force on two masses. But so he, for instance, it tells you on why the Earth revolves around the sun, but he didn't explain the mechanism behind it. I mean, you've got the mathematics, you know what the forces are, but how does it work? How does the sun actually affect the Earth? If you're going to do something that affects me, then there should be something, some sort of connection that connects us somehow. There should be some sort of mechanism that does it. And so what Einstein did, of course, with his general theory of relativity, and he came up with this description of space-time and space-time distorting. And so he changed it from this idea of this action at a distance to local realism. The Earth moves the way it does move because the sun has distorted the space-time near us. And so the Earth is moving according to the space-time that surrounds the Earth. So that's what local realism is. And this has to do with entanglement and this idea that when you measure, we've got two entangled qubits, and you measure your qubit, and my qubit immediately jumps to a new state. And this is, according to the Copenhagen interpretation, this is instantaneous. Einstein really didn't like this. He felt that there ought to be some other deeper theory, that explains it, and that my qubit couldn't just jump unless something acting in its environs affected it. So that's local realism. And hidden variables is the idea that there's a deeper theory. So here, for example, we toss a coin, and we think of tossing a coin in some sense as being random. When we talk about random experiments, we're always talking about tossing coins. But in physics, a coin toss is not a random thing. And we feel that if we could, it's sort of sensitive dependence on initial conditions, but if we knew the conditions precisely, if we knew the exact pressure of my thumb on the coin, we knew the viscosity of the air and so on, if we knew all these conditions, we'd be able to predict, with certainty whether it's going to land up heads or tails. It's just that we don't know all these extra variables. And so the hidden variable thing with quantum mechanics is saying, well, perhaps there's a deeper theory with more variables, and if we knew these, then this probabilistic aspect of quantum mechanics would disappear. All the experiments show that's not the case, that you cannot get rid of this randomness. It's just a natural part of quantum mechanics.
Was that the conclusion that John Bell reached in the 60s?
Yes. Yeah, so he came up with a really remarkable experiment. And it's just a pity that Einstein and Bohr weren't alive when this first experiment was done. So Einstein and Bohr were all through the 20s and 30s, they were arguing backwards and forwards. Bohr believed in this Heisenberg, in this Copenhagen interpretation of measurements cause states to jump. But Einstein never bought into this. And so they were arguing backwards and forwards. And it wasn't clear that you could test whether one was right and one was wrong. We certainly know that the Copenhagen interpretation gives the right results, but maybe there's some deeper theory. And Bell came up with this really clever experiment to distinguish these, to tell whether there could be local realism and hidden variables, or whether this Copenhagen interpretation is correct. And so it requires sort of, again, entanglement and a series of measurements. And it's sort of since been done several times, and the results are always in favor of the Copenhagen interpretation, always in favor of this inherent randomness and measurements making states jump.
Chris, we've just spent a lot of time on quantum, and now let's get to computing. What is a logical operation?
A logical operation? Logic includes things like and, or, not. So when you learn logic, you have logic tables. So we have things like P and Q, where P and Q represent statements that could have truth value. They're either true or they're false. And so these connectives like and, so here P and Q, that will be true only in the case when both P and Q are true. And you know, if P is true but Q is false, or Q is false but P is true, or they're both false, then P and Q will be false. So you get these truth tables. And so we can connect up more complicated statements using and, or, nots, and other connectives like this. And they're, of course, connected to what's called Boolean algebra. Instead of using true and false, we can use the numbers 0 and 1. And so we're getting back to bits now. And then and say, so if we have the and gate, so here we now put two things in, two inputs into the AND gate. They could either be 0, 0, in which case it's like having false, false. And so here the output would be false, or in this case, the output would be 0. And again, with the AND gate, the only way you're going to get 1 as an output is if you put 1 and 1 as input. And so so these logic gates act very much like, connectives in logic.
Are gates logical constructs, or are they physical things such as circuits that you see in computers?
So they're both. So they're constructs, but no, you can actually construct gates. And so here, you actually string a lot of gates together in what's called a circuit. So here you have wires coming in, and you know they connect to a gate, and then you get a wire coming out of the gate. So here, they're mainly used for thinking about computation. But no, you can actually build gates.
Okay, that's what I wanted to get at, whether or not they were logical constructs, whether or not they could be so they're logical constructs that can be realized as circuits.
So circuit has a certain meaning in computer science. So circuit is
connectional wires.
Yeah, so circuits, they're not, in computer science, they're not sort of circuitous things. They're sort of linear things. They go from left to right. And here you input, they have wires that start on the left, and they go through a series of gates. And then output is again wires, and so they're read from left to right, and from the left you put it in the input of zeros and ones. They go through these logic gates, and output is a set of zeros and ones.
Okay, now we come to where I started learning about stuff in your book. What is a universal gate?
Well, so for logical connectives we have things like and, or, not, and so the corresponding gates and the question is, you could come up with your own gate. It would just be a thing that has a series of zeros and ones, or a series of wires going into it, and a series of wires coming out, and a rule that tells me what sort of combination of zeros and ones going in gives me what sort of combination of zeros and ones coming out. You could just invent any infinite number of gates. But the question is there a fundamental gate which you can just wire up? And just use this one gate over and over again and just wire it up and get the same result as any other gate. And the surprising answer is that there is. So one such universal gate is called the NAND gate, which stands for not and. And so here it's like the AND gate but negated. So here the only way you can get a one out of a NAND gate, so a NAND gate has two inputs and one output. The only way you can get one out of a NAND gate is by inputting two zeros. Or in the other three cases, you get a zero coming out as output. And it's sort of a really surprising result that you can wire up. All you need to construct a circuit are a whole bunch of NAND gates. You can wire them up to obtain any other circuit you like.
Hey, that's very interesting. And as I say, we're starting to learn about things that I was starting to learn about when I read your book. What is fan out?
Okay, so here, this is something that is important when we come to start talking about quantum computing. So in classical computing, we always say that, you know, NAND is a universal gate. But what should be pointed out is that you also have to use this other operation called fan out. And what that is that when you have a wire, you're allowed to sort of solder another wire to it and to split the signal. So that here, you might have just one wire coming in, and then you solder this other wire to it. So now you've got two wires, and it splits the incoming signal. So here, if you had a one coming down it, now you have two ones going along these separate wires. Or if you had zero coming in, now you have two zeros going along these separate wires. So it's called fan out. It's really splitting the signal. And it could be just called copying the signal. You're making another copy of the signal. So here, you need to be able to use that in addition to NAND gates to construct any circuit whatsoever. So you need that fundamental operation. And why it's important is that you cannot do that with in quantum computing. So here, you cannot copy an arbitrary qubit and end up with two qubits that are identical. So, and that's called the no cloning theorem. And really it means that you can't do this fan out operation for arbitrary qubits.
Okay, what is a reversible gate and why is it needed for quantum computing?
Okay, so reversible gates are ones that you can look at the output from the gate and then tell you what the input was. So if we look at the AND gate, for instance, and we look at the output and we're told the output is zero, and we don't know what the input is. I mean, it could be 0, 0, or it could be 0, 1, or it could be 1, 0. And the only thing it rules out, it couldn't be 1, 1. So if we look at the output, we can't tell what the input is. With a reversible gate, if you've got the output, then you can tell what the input must have been. In quantum computing, all the gates are reversible. So if you're given any output from a quantum gate, you know what the input must have been. And so in particular, if you've got two wires coming into a gate, you must have two wires leaving a gate. And this relates to physics and the laws of physics. And the laws of physics are reversible. And so in quantum computing, all of these computations are reversible.
You've sort of touched on this, but what is the difference between a quantum gate and a classical gate? Is it that a quantum gate must be reversible and a classical gate need not be?
So that's certainly true. Quantum gates must be reversible. Classical gates need not be. Of course, I mean, quantum gates operate on qubits, of course, and classical gates just operate on bits. But quantum gate is not just that it's reversible. In some sense, it's doing something like rotating or reflecting. It's preserving other properties. So it's very much like sort of rotating your coordinates through 45 degrees, that sort of thing. You're making sort of a substitution.
Okay, that's...
And of course, actually, one thing that really should be stressed, that as qubits go through a gate, no measurements are being made. So there's no jumping as you go through the gates. The only jumping is right at the very end of the computation when you measure your qubits.
Okay, you mentioned that the NAND gate was a universal gate for a classical computer. You then discuss whether or not you can find a finite set of quantum gates that are universal for quantum computing. Why is this important and can you do it?
So, well, of course, it's just, it's mathematically sort of interesting idea. You can do this for classical computing. Can you do it for quantum computing? And the answer is no, there isn't. Well, there's a theoretical answer. The theoretical answer is no, there isn't a universal quantum gate. And that really just hinges on the fact that we have so many different types of qubits. So here, remember, if I look at a qubit, it can be any mixture of 0 and 1, and there are infinitely many of them. And so it's hard to get an infinitely many things out of just a finite number of gates. So that's essentially the argument why there is no universal quantum gate or finite collection of quantum gates. But in practice, there are a finite number of gates that are used, and all computations that have been done so far have used this relatively few number of gates. So in practice, we're only using a few quantum gates.
You discussed some other things which I found extremely interesting, and I'm going to get to them. One was super dense coding. What is that?
Yep. So this is a way. So here, I want to send to you 2 bits of information, and I'm going to do this by sending you just 1 qubit. And of course, first this sounds
difficult
to do. Pardon?
You could send me a vector.
Right, right. So I could send you a vector, and you're going to make a measurement. Now, of course, when you make a measurement, right, it's just going to jump to 0 or 1. So, but I want to send you 2 qubits. So I want to send you either, I'm sorry, I want to send you 2 bits. So I want to send you either 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1. But I'm going to do it just by sending you 1 qubit. And you, of course, you can only get one measurement from this qubit. And so the way that we do this, I mean, it involves entanglement. And so we also, so I should also say that we have a pair of entangled qubits we just happen to have. And so this, there's a way of doing this, that it uses our entangled qubits and this qubit I'm sending you to send you 2 bits of information. You, after you've received my qubit, you measure your qubit and this qubit you just received. And here you'll read off the information I was trying to send you. You'll read off 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1.
Okay, we then hit an idea which I loved called quantum teleportation. Could you explain that, please?
Yeah, so this is the idea of sending a qubit. And this has actually been done. So a Chinese research team has actually sent a qubit from Earth to a satellite in low Earth.
I think I saw that. Is that within the last few years?
Yeah, so I forget, yeah. 2 or 3 years ago they did this. So it's a stunning result. So the idea is that here I want to send you a qubit. And again, we have a pair of entangled particles. And then somebody gives me a qubit. And I don't know what state this qubit's in. I cannot know what state this qubit's in. Because if I make any measurement of it, it's going to jump. But I want to send you that qubit. Or I want you to have that qubit. And so what I do is, and this is very clever, I entangle that qubit with my qubit that's entangled with your qubit, and then I make a measurement of my 2 qubits that I've got in my possession, and that sends your qubit almost into the state that I'm trying to send to you, this qubit that was given to me. It's almost in the right state. In fact, it's one of 4 possibilities. And the 4 possibilities we can work out depending on the measurement I got from measuring my 2 qubits. So here, then I send you the results of my 2 measurements. And with those, you can send your qubit through the appropriate gate, and you'll end up with a qubit that was in the state of the original qubit that was handed to me. And what's really interesting here is that, I mean, I never knew what the state of this qubit was, and you never knew what the state of that qubit was, but you ended up with this qubit in that state.
That's really fascinating. And one of the things also that I'm in my 70s, and when I started studying mathematics, computer science was sort of in its infancy. There had been Turing and some results that had been, you know, had been done during the 30s and 40s. But all of a sudden, the mathematics of computing exploded sometime in the last half of the 20th century. And there were some fascinating results. And one of them is, as I'm sure you know, it's one of the clay millennium problems involving whether or not P and NP are the same class. And perhaps you could explain what the complexity classes P and NP are.
Yeah. So, well, first of all, P stands for polynomial time. NP stands for non-deterministic polynomial time, which is a little bit more complicated. But in practice, what it means is that we're talking about the amount of time taken to solve a problem in terms of the size of the problem. So if I ask you to factor 15, then you can do that fairly quickly.
I can do that quickly.
But if I were to give you a 10-digit number and ask you to factor that, that would take a lot more time.
I'll be here for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And so the time grows. And in practice, we found that the time grows sort of exponentially, certainly not polynomially. On the other hand, if I give you 2 5-digit figures and ask you to multiply them together, that it takes more time than multiplying 2 2-digit numbers together, but not that much more time. You can do that fairly quickly. And so factorization is a really important problem. And so we think that to factor a product of two primes is something that is not, we can't do that in polynomial time. We think, nobody's got a proof of that, but we think we can't do that in polynomial time. That as the size of the problem grows, the difficulty seems to grow exponentially. On the other hand, if you're given the answer, and say, well, actually that 10-digit number, I think it's the product of this number and that number, you can check the answer fairly easily. So checking the answer, you can probably do in polynomial time. And so that's the idea. So non-deterministic polynomial time, NP, are really problems that you can check the answer in polynomial time. And P are questions that you can solve in polynomial time. So we think factorizing a large number, we think that's not in P. We don't think we can factor that in polynomial time. On the other hand, we can certainly, if somebody tells us what the answer is, we can certainly check that answer is correct in polynomial time. So we think factorization is something that belongs to NP, but not to P. And of course, the big question is, are they really different complexity classes? Is there really anything that separates P and NP? Is there any problem that we can definitely prove you can't solve it in polynomial time, but you can check the answers correct in polynomial time? And the answer is nobody's found one. I mean, I think most people believe that P and NP are different classes, that there will be some problem. There must be some problem you can prove you can't solve in polynomial time. You can check the answers correct in polynomial time. It just seems such an obvious thing, but nobody's been able to prove it. And as you say, it's one of the millennium problems, that if you can come up with a proof of this, then or a disproof of it, you'll win $1 million. So it's a great problem.
Yeah, it's a fascinating problem. I'd like to conclude the interview with your description of a couple of fascinating algorithms with which I was not familiar. What is Deutsch's algorithm and what did it prove?
Okay, so Deutsch's algorithm was he proved this in 1985, and this was the first algorithm to show that you could do something faster with a quantum computer than you could do classically. And so the algorithm and the problem are really not that important. The problem was constructed just to prove that a quantum computer could solve it more quickly than a classical computer. So it's not actually a practical problem, but it was the first time that it had been shown that quantum computers could do things faster than classical computers. So it's an important result.
Sort of remind me of Gödel's proof where he originally constructed an undecidable proposition, which nobody cared about, but he did show that it was an undecidable proposition.
Right, exactly. That's exactly. Yeah. So,
What is Grover's algorithm, and to which problems does it apply?
So Grover's algorithm is, again, it's another fascinating algorithm. So let me give you an example. Suppose that we've got four playing cards face down in front of you. And one of them's the Queen of Hearts. And so all you're allowed to do is turn over a card, and you've got to try and find the Queen of Hearts. So you turn over the first card, and there's probability that you might find Queen of Hearts in your first go, and the probability is right 1/4. But I mean, usually you're going to need to take another go, so you might turn over the second card, and that may or may not be the Queen of Hearts. If you find it, you found it, that's good. If you don't find it, then you're going to have to turn over a third card. And once you've turned over the third card, then you know where the Queen of Hearts must be. So on average, it takes 2 1/4 tries, 2 1/4 turns to find the Queen of Hearts. So that's classically. Grover's algorithm, and again, this is something that you just, when you first see it, you don't believe it's possible. But here, Grover's algorithm does this with just one question. Apply the function once, and so you find the Queen of Hearts in the first go. So it's a remarkable result. The actual algorithm is described as searching data, or it's like inverse searching, given a phone number, searching through a phone book to find the address. I don't know that it's particularly applicable for that, in that there are other search algorithms, classic search algorithms, that are fairly efficient. And certainly if there's any structure to your data set, then you could probably find a more efficient way of doing it than using Grover's algorithm. I think Grover's algorithm is more important for, again, the idea, the trick there, that you could probably build into other algorithms. So a lot of these first algorithms, we're seeing, what made this work? And let's use this idea in the future in other algorithms that are going to be more useful.
Well, one of the things that I've learned about science and mathematics over the course of my lifetime is that you never say, this is not going to be useful. you just never know. Chris, what do you see as the potential of quantum computing, say, within the next few decades?
I think it's very dangerous to predict what's going to happen in the distant future. But in the near future, I think probably the most exciting areas are going to be in terms of chemistry. So chemistry at its most fundamental level is a quantum phenomenon, involves quantum phenomena, and it makes a lot of sense to simulate this on quantum computers. So I think there's going to be lots of applications to chemistry. But the application I'm an educator, that I'm more interested in is us all being able to play with quantum computers. And IBM has actually put a little 5-qubit quantum computer in the cloud. Anyone can play with it. Anyone can play with it for free. And I think this is very exciting. So I think we're now getting to the stage where anyone can play with a quantum computer. And I'm hoping that everyone can learn a little bit about quantum computing. So I think we're getting to the stage where we're going to see many more of us just playing around with quantum computing. I mean, I think that really it could become part of the high school curriculum.
Chris, this has been just fascinating stuff. I'd like to know if you have any ongoing projects that might interest our listeners and how our listeners can get in touch with you.
Yeah, so I'm just sort of thinking about various things. So I've got no project that's really gone very far at the moment.
Well, get in touch with me when you got one or when you write a book.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So the way to get hold of me is by email, and that my university email address is cbernhardt@fairfield.edu.
Chris, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.